All right, we'll go ahead and get started in this next class in our Old Testament survey. Last week being our introduction to the prophets with the rise of prophetism in Israel, my plan is to take one prophet a week as we find it laid out in the Bible, and we'll start this week with the book of Hosea. Some of these books are obviously a little longer than others, but we're not going to look at every element of every prophet, but we will try to catch some of the major themes and take a look at what was said in particularly insightful ways and what contributions they made to the history of redemption and to the work of both kingdoms. Generally speaking, I'd like to try to address the five points I've got listed there. Who was the prophet? When did he operate? And what were the major themes of his ministry, as well as any significant predictions that they made, and also what particular elements of hope that they attempted to communicate during their ministry. So, generally speaking, we may combine a few things. Predictions and hope are somewhat combined for some of the prophets, but not all of them. So that's pretty much the working outline. It is my intention to allow you to ask questions at time to time. Last week we didn't have time for that, but we will try to work in questions this week. So let's get started. You will need a Bible for these classes, and there's a stack of them over there if you don't have one. But turn to the book of Hosea, and we'll get started to answer the question exactly who was Hosea. So looking at chapter 1, verse 1, we read, "The word of the Lord that came to Hosea the son of Beeri in days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, Hezekiah, kings of Judah in the days of Jeroboam, and Joash, king of Israel." Well, all that we know about the person of Hosea is contained in the first half of the first verse. We know his dad's name, and that's about it, in terms of who he was personally. He was the son of Beeri, but of Beeri we know nothing either. And so looking to his lineage isn't much of a help in this particular case. The general meaning of his name means salvation, or the Lord saves. And outside of that, we really don't know anything biographically regarding Hosea. So the next question asked then is, when did he prophesy? And this is a very important element, especially for Hosea. It's not for other prophets, but for Hosea it is. Hosea marks the his ministry beginning in, if you'll notice back in verse 1, in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel. Now, what's important, I think it's very important to keep this in remembrance. Over on the left-hand column, you have the kings of Israel, Jeroboam II, Zechariah, Shallum, Menahem, Pekahiah, Pekah, and Hoshea are all listed there. And that's a little misleading in one sense. The column on the left, though it spans about the same time as the column on the right, it's greater than the column on the right. The difficulty is that from Zechariah on down to Hosea, some of those kings died off pretty quickly. Their reigns were all fairly short, and that's an important, and they didn't die natural causes either. Over on the right-hand side, the kings of Judah, starting with Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. What's interesting to note about this is that Hosea was principally a prophet to the northern kingdom. He didn't spend his time in the southern kingdom, but he marks the boundaries of his reign principally by those four kings mentioned on the kings of Judah. And almost incidentally, or in addition to Jeroboam the second there. So the difficulty with trying to ascertain the exact timeline for Hosea is that we don't know when during Jeroboam's reign that he begun his ministry. And that's, Jeroboam had such a long reign that trying to find the exact point that Hosea comes on the scene is problematic. So, and the text tells us in the days of Jeroboam and not at the beginning of Jeroboam's reign. So I think, largely speaking, we can put his starting point somewhere in the 783 to 793 BC era. We don't know exactly when with Jeroboam, but there's some discrepancy as to when Jeroboam's reign actually began in terms of the precise year. So we'll leave it in that general ballpark. And the ending point, if you look back through the kings all the way through Hezekiah, and you remember by the time Hezekiah is on the scene, that we already have the Assyrians in full strength, and the northern kingdom has already fallen when we get to that point. So that took place somewhere around 721. Now, there's a great deal of conjecture, depending on what school you're from the rabbis and such, my understanding, on exactly how long Hosea did have an active ministry. Some put it as long as 84 years. Others put it into the high 50s. I think the high 50s is very probable. Could have been in the low 60s as well. Those are 60 years of active ministry. And that's a long time. So I think, without getting distracted with too much labor over the precision of all the dates involved, you can see that Hosea had a very, very long ministry. And he had an opportunity to see a great deal. So I'd like to paint the picture just a bit, because it'll help understand some of the prophecies involved. But during Jeroboam's reign, Israel, while steeped in apostasy, certainly, was a military powerhouse in those early days. They were not a puny country. The beginning of this time, where we're looking at, if you wanted to put Hosea into the historical narrative books in the Kings and Chronicles, you'd see, going back to Jeroboam in 2 Kings 14 through 23 and 25. And one of the key verses to understanding the times there, in the 15th year of Amaziah, son of Joash, king of Judah, Jeroboam, son of Joash, king of Israel, became king in Samaria and reigned 41 years. So at some point between when he reigned and those 41 years, Hosea comes on the scene. And he did evil in the sight of the Lord, and he did not depart from all the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel sin. It says he also restored the territory of Israel from the entrance of Hamath to the Sea of Araba. So there was an expansion and a reclaiming of territory that had been previously yielded, and there was much in the way of commerce and the beginning of an economic movement. But things peaked about that time in Jeroboam's reign, and they started to decline rapidly, which is one of the reasons we had so many tin can despots, I think is the term we'd use for some of those folks who reigned, is that there was a real decline in Israel, and they had not departed from the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. So the times had begun to change, I think, and is a fair characterization of what was happening in the northern kingdoms. Now, for the time period involved in the southern kingdoms, the kings of Judah, beginning there with Uzziah, we can find that time period corresponding to 2 Chronicles 26:32, up there on the right, chapters 26 through 32. During this time, we have all these kings mentioned up there on the board, and the verdict is mixed on their overall performance. At some points, the kingdom was very strong in external measurements, such as what you find during Uzziah's reign. He had done quite a bit for the country, actually. And of Jotham, it is said that he became mighty, and of Hezekiah, it is said that he had very great riches and honor. So there's a real difference in how the land is being governed and how life is transpiring there in between the northern and the southern kingdoms. So I think if you consider the political transition that would have occurred through Hosea's lifetime, and consider the difference in general economic and military outputs, I think it's fair to say that Hosea had seen just about everything there was to see. I mean, he had been through it all, been through all the turmoil involved with the politics and with bloodshed, and he had seen it. There wasn't much that was going to catch him by surprise. Largely speaking, when we use this phrase, beware that we're not talking next door neighbors necessarily, but of the four prophets generally considered to be contemporaries of Hosea, you'd find Amos, Isaiah, Micah, and Jonah. And the putting Jonah there is somewhat speculative, although I think it's probably okay. Now you can see already just the difference in the working knowledge we have of these four prophets listed up there. When you see Amos, who was a prophet to the northern kingdom, and Isaiah and Micah and Jonah. Jonah doesn't even spend his time prophesying to Israel. And so even though these people were contemporaries, they probably knew each other to some degree, had some overlap in time, but their messages were very different and they were being scattered about. So there's quite a bit of work that's been done to show the similarity in how people have borrowed from one another in their prophecies and how they would go back and cite one another. Jeremiah is known for citing a few references. Amos and Joel cite references with one another. Isaiah has references from other prophets. You know, it's a little bit of arguing who came first in this particular circumstance, but there is a high degree of commonality in the message of the prophets at times. They touch points, and at those points, you can see they were working together to strengthen the message that was brought forth. So let's move on to the major themes of Hosea's prophecies, and we're going to look at a few accounts here. Largely want to focus on his marriage, the children, and the place of the law in the life of Hosea. I think it's helpful to get a characterization of the whole book when you're starting off, so you have an idea of what to anticipate. And Matthew Henry did a very good job of summarizing the book of Hosea. He said the scope of his prophecy is to discover sin and to denounce the judgments of God against a people that would not be reformed. The style is very concise and sententious, above any of the prophets, and in some places it seems to be like a book of Proverbs without connection, and rather to be called Hosea's sayings rather than Hosea's sermons. So, you know, with Joel, for instance, well, as we'll see next week, you see a large prophecy contained that is, for the most part, considered to be highly contiguous, but with Hosea you don't see that same thing. So given the fact that he could have been out there for 60 years and probably had a lot more to say than what was recorded in canon, that would seem to make some sense. All right, so let's go on with the marriage of Hosea. Now, say at the onset that commentators, I haven't actually tallied them, but I'd say they're just about equally divided as to whether or not Hosea actually married a wife named Gomer, a wife of harlotry. There are, I found, very strong arguments on both sides. My conclusion, and I'll state some of those reasons for us, is that he probably did. And we'll take a look at one account. So if you still have Hosea open, let's go to chapter 1 still, and we'll pick it up in verse 2. When the Lord began to speak by Hosea, the Lord said to Hosea, "Go, take yourself a wife of harlotry and children of harlotry, for the land has committed great harlotry by departing from the Lord." So he went and took Gomer, the wife of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. Well, part of why I think it's reasonable in this account is that the account is listed as a historical narrative. It's given to Hosea personally. It doesn't describe him as dreaming this, or I saw that the Lord had taken me in a vision. The picture is God told him to go do this. There are specific children named that of different sexes. So we have two boys and a girl, I think. So there's a complete biographical picture here. The prophets were certainly allowed to be married, and the wives of the prophets were not outside the boundaries of being affected by their ministries of their husbands. We see during the term of Ezekiel how he was his wife was taken from him, was killed, and as a sign, Ezekiel was told to stay there and be quiet. domestic life was not off balance, and so it was. It's not an unreasonable thing that God decided to make Hosea's life itself a picture to the rest of the children of Israel. It's entirely likely that Gomer was not a harlot when they got married, but that God, in his infinite wisdom, knew that this would be, in fact, the case. I think that's my opinion of what took place, that she was not a harlot when they got married, but God knew that she would become one. Now, there are a couple, aside just a few reasons against, is that Calvin makes the point that Hosea doesn't meet the requirements of being an elder. Which I thought was interesting. And that a domestic life this distracted or this troublesome would be a grave distraction. There's something to that. Chapter 3 has some textual considerations that make it a little difficult in understanding exactly what Hosea was doing there. Whether that's a separate account or a picture of this account has been the matter of some speculation. I don't think it's completely settled. But it's problematic either way. But I think in either case, excessive focus on the details of the marriage prove only to be a serious distraction from what the marriage was intended to convey. Whether the marriage was allegorical or literal or not, should not that argument should not distract us from what is being communicated to us through the marriage of Hosea. The marriage, as it was described for us, was not for Hosea's enjoyment or pleasure. The whole marriage was to convey the message that Israel had committed adultery by serving other gods. They had forsaken their first love. So this theme is something that will occur over and over again through Hosea's prophecies. Let's go to chapter 2, and I'll read starting in verse 2. So you see that this is another edict of another sermon preached. Bring charges against your mother, bring charges, for she is not my wife, nor am I her husband. Let her put away her harlotries from her sight, and her adulteries from between her breasts, lest I strip her naked and expose her, as in the day she was born, and make her like a wilderness, and set her like a dry land, and slay her with thirst. I will not have mercy on her children, for they are the children of harlotry. For their mother has played the harlot, she who conceived them has behaved shamefully. For she said, I will go after my lovers, who give me bread and my water, my wool and my linen, my oil and my drink. So here is another section that is put in terms of this marriage illustration, yet is there to convey not that people had a legitimate claim against Gomer, but that God had a claim against the people of Israel and what they had done because of the outright wantonness practiced in the land. Let's go to chapter 4, and let's look at starting in, I'll read verse 1, and then we'll move down to 11. Hear the word of the Lord, you children of Israel. So, for the Lord brings a charge against the inhabitants of the land. Here is the edict being brought forth from God himself against the people in verse 11. Harlotry, wine, and new wine enslave the heart. My people ask counsel from their wooden idols, and their staff informs them. For the spirit of harlotry has caused them to stray, and they played the harlot against their God. They offer sacrifices on the mountaintops and burn incense on the hills, under oaks, poplars, and terebinths, because their shade is good. Therefore their daughters commit harlotry, and their brides commit adultery. So again, sexual immorality is not the only sin being addressed in these passages. It certainly was a problem that the children of Israel had at more times. It was more severe at times than at others. But the real problem here is the worship. They had gone after these other idols, and they had corrupted the practices of worship. Certainly, they had gone after idols and had adulterated themselves. Against whom? Well, against the Lord himself. He had pledged himself to Israel, and this is how they conducted themselves. Now, the prosecution makes a case here in verse 11 that the heart of the people is enslaved. I think that's an interesting use of language there. They are no longer free to serve the living God. but in fact they've been delivered to their carnal nature. It would be, in fact, one thing and one complaint that would be brought if the people had never tasted of God's goodness and had known nothing of God and of His law. You might be able to argue that they had lived in darkness, nothing but darkness, and known nothing else. But that scenario doesn't apply to this people here, to the audience that Hosea is bringing these oracles. They had God's word and they had His prophets. That was the whole reason Hosea was there. The charges against them are from the first table of the law. Here, they've worshipped other gods, and God says that is akin to playing the harlot. You've gone after other gods. Now, they've also corrupted the worship practices, so they violated the next commandment as well. When you see the severity of this oracle pronounced against the people, it makes you marvel at God's goodness and His great love to abide with the people for as long as He did. It is indeed a patient, long-suffering, merciful God to tolerate His wanton people. It's an amazing thing. The language used here is not to describe the fornication or the adultery of immorality, but to describe the way the people had treated their God in abandoning Him. When you abandon God, you're committing adultery. That's the message that Hosea is bringing forth. That's the message. Look, if I don't do it now, it may never happen. Are there any questions or comments at this stage?
Observation. I mean, here it's about relationships and violated relationships. It's not so much, we certainly get a sense of awe and are awestruck by the very presence of God and the nearness of God. In fact, the Roman Catholic Church captures that very, very well. You know, that in the setting apart of this thing, right?
Yeah.
But the relationship is the part that's so often, it's easy to miss, you know, in our forms and all that we would seek to do. Physical, it's not where our heart is in relationship to God.
Right. That's a very important element of Hosea. Rob?
Does this kind of speak to our situation now in the United States with the generations past that served God, but now the mainline churches have become corrupt in their worship, and certainly there's great idolatry in those churches, and we have sexual immorality to go along with it.
Yeah, for the sake of the tape, the question was, do the themes of Hosea apply to us today, given the current state? Yes, absolutely, you're right. And we'll see, actually, the message of the Minor Prophets is still very applicable for the church today and for the land that we find ourselves. So I agree, this is a very important message. The message is hammered home again in Joel next week that we'll look at. Hosea is bringing a serious charge against the people for the corruption, that they abandoned the following of the Lord their God. Right?
Struck me that, I can't remember her name, but the harlot from Jericho.
Rahab.
She ended up being in the lineage of Christ. And it seems to me in the second chapter, starting at verse 14, God is calling to them, graciously calling, and says, I will do all these things. His graciousness, no matter where we are, when He calls, it is a gracious call, and best I can determine, it's hard to resist the Lord at that point.
No, you got a good point. We're going to actually hit that on section 5 there. We've got a prophet in our midst too, speaking right to the heart of it. You're right. Lisa?
The other sort of interesting, kind of following on the theme of the church and the church It's interesting that this woman that's described in here is blessed with many, many, many things, and doesn't see that as the hand of her husband, but instead of attributing to, she's chasing after other things, really. And
right.
I think when I look here for an application for my own life, it's like how quick I am to attribute blessings, you know, to some secondary source and not to really see it coming from the hand of God, and how that has just been a recipe for the heart to strength towards, you know, the created order instead of the creation.
Right. Sure. Let's move on to the second major theme in Hosea, back to chapter 1. We'll look at the children of Hosea. Let's pick this up in verse 3. So he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. Then the Lord said to him, call his name Jezreel, for in a little while I will avenge the bloodshed of Jezreel on the house of Jehu, and bring an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. It shall come to pass in that day that I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. So here we have this, what appears to be an historical account. It wasn't that the word of the Lord came and Gomer conceived or brought forth a child, but Gomer brings forth a child, and God intervenes in the naming of this kid. So I think... To show the direct applicability of what Hosea was trying to communicate to the people there, that Jezreel is mentioned, call his name Jezreel. Well, Jezreel was the location of Naboth's vineyard, which Ahab stole many years earlier through deceit and murder. You'll recall that he wanted it, and he started pouting, and Jezebel got involved and helped him concoct this plan. It was also the occasion, Jezreel was the occasion, of Elijah's pronouncement of the death sentence. Jehu was commissioned by an unnamed prophet at Elisha's command. Elisha said, told one of his underlings from presumably the school of the prophets, said, you go to Jehu and commission him as king. And it was at Jezreel that Ahab's house was removed, exterminated. So Jezreel has played a very important part, and even though this had happened sometime before, the blood that was spilled there was not forgotten. And Jehu was a godless man. It's true that he obeyed the commandment of that. Let me put it this way. It appears that the only command he seems to have obeyed was that of killing. That's probably a better way to put it. God's purpose here was to finish the people who had cut themselves off from the house of David. That was the purpose of God in pronouncing this judgment. So here we have a picture of something immediate, yet long-term, because the fall of the northern kingdom did not take place at this time. Let's move over to verse 6 here and see the second child. And she conceived again and bore a daughter. Then God said to him, call her name Loruhamah. For I will no longer have mercy on the house of Israel, but I will utterly take them away. Yet I will have mercy on the house of Judah, will save them by the Lord their God, and will not save them by bow, nor by sword, nor battle, by horses or horsemen. So here we have God's forbearance displayed in the... it's interesting, the mechanism he uses for this. He's describing the mercy he will show to Judah, to be contrasted with the mercy that he will not show the kingdom of Israel. He said, I'm not going to show them mercy, but with Judah I am, and I will save them, and not by their own right hand. So in verse 8 we have the third child. Now when she had weaned Loruhamah, she conceived and bore a son. Then God said, call his name Lo-Ami, for you are not my people, and I will not be your God. We'll leave it right there. This child, his name means forsaken, and that now God disavows the relationship he has with his people. This is to remind us of the severity of the message, the severity of their sins, that God has declared them to be forsaken. The message from the last two children is that the time is past for reconciliation. I don't want to press this point too hard, but some commentators have found there to be a helpful indicator that in the naming of the first child, or the description of the coming of the first child, it specifically said that it was given to Hosea. But in child two and child three, it simply says that Gomer bore a son, or bore a child, rather than specifically indicating that Hosea was the father. So that was one textual evidence that is sometimes cited to help with this idea of Gomer being a historical figure. Let's move on to the law as the third section, the third major theme of what Hosea has. And let's, for that, turn over to chapter 8, and we'll pick it up in verse 12. And we'll move this thing along here. Chapter 8, 12. Well, back it up to 11. Because Ephraim has made many altars for sin, they have become for him altars for sinning. I have written for him the great things of my law, but they were considered a strange thing. For the sacrifices of my offerings, they sacrifice flesh and eat it, but the Lord does not accept them. Now he will remember their iniquity and punish their sins. They shall return to Egypt. For Israel has forgotten his maker and has built temples. Judah has also multiplied fortified cities. But I will send fire upon his cities, and I will devour his palaces. Well, here God describes, in fact, his own law and the very wonder of it all. These people were so far from God's law that they considered a strange thing. In verse 12, I have written for him the great things of my law, but they were considered a strange thing. God says, I've given you this law to conduct yourself. And the people, this is really bizarre. What's contained in this document? What's it for? Another indication that their worship was nothing more than in form only. They sacrificed, and specifically mentioned, but that their hearts are far from him. Now, one of the haunting things about this particular section, particularly in verse 13, is that God pronounces a judgment on them. He says, now he will remember their iniquity and punish their sins. Well, what does he intend to do? He intends to send them back to Egypt. Now, he doesn't mean that they will be geographically relocated. In fact, they end up, depending on the time frame, 50, 60 years, going the other direction. They head north. So what could it possibly mean by they're going to send him back to Egypt? They're going to send him back to a land of idolatry. They're going to send him back to lawlessness, that these people will not be guided anymore by that light that God had for all those years, led the people through the wilderness and into the land with great deliverance. He says, no. They want to live like the Egyptians, they will act like Egyptians. And he's sending them back in that sense to go back to where from whence they were delivered. Let's go back to Hosea 4. We'll skip back there. We'll pick up another way in which Hosea brings an indictment for the breaking of the law. And we see this in 2 and 3. And we read verse 1 earlier, God bringing the pronouncement of the charge against them, and this is in the prosecutorial tone. For the Lord brings the charge against the inhabitants of the land. There is no truth or mercy or knowledge in the land. By swearing and lying, killing, stealing, and committing adultery, they break all restraint with bloodshed upon bloodshed. Therefore the land will mourn, and everyone who dwells there will waste away with the beasts of the field and the birds of the air. Even the fish of the sea will be taken away. So, Israel here, we've read earlier in the ways in which they had defiled the first table of God's law in their practices of worship and their harlotry. But here, they are specifically listed as breaking commandments 6 through 9. Now, this was not Hosea lurking about in dark places to find somebody who he could accuse of lying because he was desperate to meet his quota of oracles of woe against the inhabitants of the land. The land was ripe with stealing and lying and theft, adultery. Well, they're listed right here as commands. Hosea is not inventing new standards of righteousness. He's going back to Moses and said, this was the law, the great law that God had given you, and you have forsaken it. the judgment pronounced is, therefore the land will mourn. The land will mourn because of this forsaking. In verse 1, another haunting verse, there is no truth or mercy or knowledge of God in the land. There's nothing. This place is as barren as it could possibly be. There is no spiritual life left. Society had completely degenerated because of the forsaking of God's law. And all of this, all of these things are given as understanding the picture of where they had fallen from under the economic and military prowess of Jeroboam II. Now, granted, it wasn't as big as the times of David or of Solomon, but he was still an effective ruler in many respects, but he was a godless man, and the place just degenerated. Look at the list of kings. The land will indeed mourn. At some point, you got to say, folks, wake up and smell the coffee. Something's happened to your land. And Hosea, the prophet, is sent to him to describe what's happened in the land. You're lying. Your worship is abominable. You're adulterers. There are many other sins for which they are indicted, and I won't go into all of them, but I'll just list them here briefly for you. Pride is another one. We find this in chapter 5, verse 5. The unreliability is another sin, and we find that in 6:4. Wickedness, generally speaking, in verses 3 through 7. Disrespect, we find in 9:7-9. The idolatry we've mentioned before, another instance in chapter 10:1-2. Idolatry again in chapter 13:1-2. And rebellion, chapter 13:16. We see that the people are held into account for the rebellion that they have committed. So the picture of Hosea that we've seen thus far is a pretty bleak one. God's assessment to the people is that they are bankrupt and have come to the complete end. So there's nothing left here that is worthwhile, nothing left that is found. And it's a marvel of God's patience and love that he sends his prophets, not just one, but other prophets, to the land to try to reclaim his people before the last judgment takes place. Let's move on to some of the predictions made in chapter 4. And Hosea's predictions, it appears, fell on deaf ears. Let's look over at chapter 10. We'll read a couple verses there that Hosea, if we understand this timeline correctly, we could see Hosea at the early stages making these prophecies and where the country is going to go. And it's theoretically possible he was old enough to actually see the fall of the Northern Kingdom. So he lived a long time, but because we don't know the boundaries, he may have actually lived and seen the day when these prophecies were fulfilled. So let's look at Hosea 10, verses 5 and 6. The inhabitants of Samaria fear because of the calf of Beth-Aven, for its people mourn for it, and its priests shriek for it, because its glory has departed from it. The idol also shall be carried to Assyria as a present for King Jerob. Ephraim shall receive shame, and Israel shall be ashamed of his own counsel. Here they describe the act of taking the idolatrous worship, which could very well have been the calves that Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, had made, or ones that had been refashioned. I don't know how well they would have endured. But Hosea is describing for them, these things are going to be taken off into Assyria at some point. Assyria is going to come, and he's going to take them. He's going to take the pride of your worship away from you. Now, this happened in 720-something or other, so it's not altogether unthinkable that Hosea would have even seen that prophecy transpire before his eyes. Certainly, one other element contained in that prophecy is that Ephraim and Israel were both ashamed and treated most disgracefully. The treatment of the Assyrians when they took them into captivity was a horrific. There are these Kiddo reports that there are these inscriptions made, or depictions rather, of the Assyrians slaying the ten tribes. A fair number of them, just mounds of flesh that they had flayed people alive before they had completely deported them. So there's a serious indication that the trouble that's about to take place is unthinkable. All right, well, Hosea's prophecies are not prophecies that are necessarily brought out as some of Daniel's prophecies, that there'll be future kingdoms here and that there'll be this and that taking place and other kingdoms being raised and others falling. Hosea's prophecies are geared much more directly onto specifically, not even all of the people of God, but on the 10 northern tribes. And that's an important thing to consider because they were the ones who had broken themselves off from following in the line of David. But Hosea does not leave the people with nothing but oracles of weal. This is not the last word, as it were, to the people. Let's look at chapter 6, and we'll see a couple verses there that and why this is particularly important is to remember that the prophecies given by God's prophets through these days were not intended to be principally understood or to be intended to be understood to the extent that they filled the land. The promises given are to bring people back to God, not just bring people back to land. At this point, they hadn't been deported yet. And as is the case in the southern kingdom, they didn't have the example of the deportation of the northern kingdom. None of this had happened yet. And so it had been forewarned in Moses that they would be carried off. And even Solomon makes mention of these things. But the restoration spoken of truly does take place in terms of land. But that's not the principal goal of the restoration. So let's look at 6 verses 1 and 2. Come and let us return to the Lord. For he has torn, but he will heal us. He has stricken, but he will bind us up. After 2 days, he will revive us. On the third day, he will raise us up, that we may live in his sight. Here we have a promise that God himself will be the one that though he has torn us, he will put us back together. Let us return to the Lord. Let's look at Hosea chapter 2, verses 21 and 22. And we can see some continuity from an older covenant being made. Let's back it up to verse 19, and we'll pick up the imagery used with regard to the marriage. I will betroth you to me forever. Yes, I will betroth you to me in righteousness and justice, in loving kindness and mercy. I will betroth you to me in faithfulness, and you shall know the Lord. It shall come to pass in that day that I will answer, says the Lord. I will answer the heavens, and they shall answer the earth. The earth shall answer with grain, with new wine, and with oil. They shall answer Jezreel. Then I will sow her for myself in the earth, and I will have mercy on her who had not obtained mercy. Then I will say to those who were not my people, you are my people. And they shall say, you are my God. You see, the curses that the oracles of woe that God has pronounced in the naming of the children is replaced here by this oracle of weal that he is putting that dates back not only to identifying the three children that Hosea had, that God had named, but also to the betrothal, indicating this marriage covenant, and I would argue even going verse 22 particularly, and to a lesser extent verse 21, you see language employed reminding us of Noah. And the promise that God makes that he will never again destroy the land as he has and will bring forth, that the earth will bring forth its produce. Let's go to Hosea 3. It should be right there. And this is really one of the best chapters. And this is, without doubt, the best chapter in Hosea. Then the Lord said to me, go again, love a woman who is loved by a lover and who is committing adultery, just like the love of the Lord for the children of Israel, who look to the other gods and love the raisin cakes of the pagans. These raisin cakes were real popular. So I bought her for myself for 15 shekels of silver and 1.5 homers of barley. And I said to her, you shall stay with me many days. You shall not play the harlot, nor shall you have a man. So too will I be toward you. For the children of Israel shall abide many days without king or prince, without sacrifice or sacred pillar, without ephod or teraphim. Afterward the children of Israel shall return and seek the Lord their God and David their king. They shall fear the Lord and his goodness in the latter days. See what a beautiful, beautiful picture is put forth here by Hosea. And it makes me a little overwhelmed to think of the magnitude of God's love for his people, that he would do this. He sees them in their sins. The condition of God's people, though they are hiding from God by acting corruptly, they don't want their sins discovered. They don't want anyone to know this. God knows who they are in their filth, in their harlotry. Their treachery is perfectly clear before him. But I think the lessons we can learn from Hosea here is that God will be reconciled to his people. He will not leave his people. His love will seek them and find them. They cannot escape the love that God intends to bestow upon his people. The words that are spoken here are comforting words. In this picture, Hosea is comforting Gomer that this act was not done reluctantly nor hesitantly, but rather with great affection. The picture giving forth is that Hosea went forth to find Gomer in her filthiness and to redeem her. On a couple of side notes, it's worth noting that the price paid here is abysmally small. The price of a servant put forth in Exodus was 30 shekels a servant, and he doesn't give anywhere near this much to for Gomer. Gives some pieces of silver and barley, I think it is, a homer and a half or something of barley. Well, I think if anything, this indicates just how low a condition that she had fallen, that this was desperate straits, that she was about at the bottom. And I think the second application that we can read from this is how we're to treat our own spouses, how we're to treat one another lovingly and affectionately. Remember, Gomer deserved to die. The punishment for adultery is a capital crime. It's the death sentence. Hosea had no legal obligation to redeem her, and he did. And this is a beautiful picture, not only of God's love for his people, but of the Christian marriage, that we live with one another in forgiveness and in a God-seeking love to reclaim and redeem those about us. Divorce is not the only answer for a relationship. God-seeking love, absolution, and affection are powerful tools of both redemption and witness. God always treats his people better than they deserve, and we ought to do the likewise. Well, we're out of time, but the last prophecy of hope that I was going to mention is in chapter 14, where Hosea means for the people to bring a sound confession of their sins, a sound confession of their sins. One of the reasons this is helpful for us today is to understand that confession, or that it's okay to be a little introspective at times. Hosea is calling the people to examine themselves and to look and see what they have done, and to repent of those sins particularly, and to turn to the Lord with all their heart, to make full amends to God, and he will see to it that they are reclaimed. So it's a beautiful picture of terrific, terrific judgments against them for their sins, but also of their redemption. It's a wonderful picture. All right, we're a little over, but we'll entertain some very quick questions.
Just an observation. When Christ meets the woman in Samaria, it kind of is a picture of Ephraim being brought back. You know, he basically puts her off, but she says, well, the crumbs are enough.
Yeah. Yeah, Christ definitely went seeking. That's right. Rob?
Didn't you just be parallel with the verse in Romans 11, or the verses in Romans 11?
Do I think this is parallel with verses 11? Well, you know, one of the... do I think this is parallel with... I assume you're referring to Paul's declaration in Romans 11 of the reclamation of the Jews at some later point?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Well, again, this is one of the elements of prophecies is that they often had immediate applications and even near-term applications and far-away applications. It'd be difficult to speak authoritatively that Paul was thinking back to Hosea, but certainly the theme is current. At some point in time, God has promised to bring his people back and reclaim them. So it certainly can extend to them, although it would have applied also to others much earlier, to the rebuilding of the temple and such.